joining us now on ACT Radio, Liz Specht. Thanks for being with us, Liz.
Hi, thanks so much for having me on.
Liz, can you start out by telling our listeners how you got involved in animal issues and veganism?
Yeah, absolutely. So I am a relatively new vegan. It's only been about a couple years for me. I've been vegetarian for a little over a decade, and it took a while, as it does for many people, I'm sure, to make that full jump. And for me, it was more of just starting to really delve into what was being written about all the issues associated with animal agriculture, and particularly the welfare issues became a big concern for me when I had first gone vegetarian back in college. It was mostly about the environment for me at that time, even though I'd always been an animal lover. So I think there was obviously some denialism probably going on there. So yeah, I think for me it was sort of the whole picture that there are no positives or necessary aspects of animal agriculture and all of these negatives associated with it. And that's when I started to kind of look around for ways that technology can help us make that transition, because to me it's very clear that this is a transition that needs to be made away from animal agriculture.
You're a senior scientist with the Good Food Institute. Can you tell us about the work of the Good Food Institute?
Absolutely. Yeah, the Good Food Institute is a relatively young nonprofit. We've really fully launched at the beginning of this year. And we're completely donor-driven philanthropic organization, and our goal essentially is to promote research, development, and of course, ultimately commercialization of new food technologies that will essentially render animal agriculture obsolete. So we work with both plant-based technologies to get new plant-based meats and such out on the market, and then we also work sort of more on the biotech side in what we call clean food tech, which is producing products that are the same as animal products, but with no animal involved. So we tackle both those routes, essentially to expand the number of options that are on the market for people who don't want to consume products of animal agriculture.
Can you tell us a little bit more about this clean technology? I'm not sure people might not fully understand what you mean, animal products without the animal.
Absolutely, yeah. So people may have heard of another term that's been used for a number of years, which is cultured meat, is one example of these clean food technologies. So that's essentially using cell culture technology, which has been developed, you know, for decades now in the biomedical industry, taking those advances and essentially growing the cells that make up meat. So there's muscle cells in there and fat cells in there and a couple other cell types in there, growing those, you know, in a clean and sterile environment rather than growing a whole animal and then slaughtering the animal.
But the cells ultimately come from animals, correct?
Is it going to be possible to continue the culture of these cells without going back to the animal, or will we have to go back to get new cells every now and then?
No, this right now, some of the techniques are still being developed to make cell lines that don't ever need to be refreshed from what we call primary cell harvest. So that's one aspect that's still under development, but there's very, very promising work in that area, and I absolutely believe that we will not have to, you know, maintain herds of donor animals or anything like that.
Or like bovine albumin serum or something like that, some nutrient broth from animal-derived products.
Yeah, so that has been a big concern historically. I'm glad you asked about that. I actually just gave a talk about this at a cultured meat conference in the Netherlands last week about some of the strategies we can use to get away from that need for bovine serum albumin in the media. And this is an area that, again, we're taking a lot of inspiration from the biomedical industry. I'm not sure if you've been following a lot of the developments in stem cell therapy, or there's this whole new field called cellular therapeutics. All of that work is done without animal products in the media because of regulatory issues. So there's of course, safety concerns in terms of viruses and prions and things like that that come from having animal components in the media for these therapeutic applications. So people in that field have been working for a long time to get away from animal components in the media, and a lot of that work can very easily be translated to this field as well.
You know, I suppose a lot of vegans won't want to eat this, but
yeah.
I'm very happy with meat alternatives from plant protein, but I think it's a great move forward for people who eat meat to switch over to this, but how are they going to get over their thought that it's, you know, it's lab meat and somehow more disgusting than tofu?
Right. Yeah, that's a great question. So first of all, just to address your comment about do vegans want this, we always say, you're already vegan. You're not our target audience, right?
Yeah.
Right. So our target audience is everyone else. But yeah, the consumer acceptance angle of this is a really interesting one, and there's actually quite a bit of research going on in sort of psychology and sociology to probe what ways to position a new product like this to increase consumer acceptance. And we're certainly doing a lot of work, you know, with individuals and with various other groups, including environmental groups, to figure out what people's concerns are and to address those, you know, in a very honest and straightforward way. Because this, with any new technology, you know, it's something people aren't familiar with it and they're not comfortable with it yet. So there's certainly a huge role to play in opening those lines of communication so that people do feel that this is a product they know what it is and how it's being made and that they can trust. And I think what's fantastic here is that you can be so transparent about this process. If we think about animal agriculture and ag gag laws and things like that, you know, we always say people eat meat not because of how it's produced, but despite how it's produced. So the benefit here is that we can be completely transparent about this process because there aren't the welfare concerns and, you know, the disgusting kind of food safety concerns that have to do with processing live animals and the conditions in which they're raised.
Right. And I think you all capture this well, is how important the terminology is. And I definitely like the use of clean or cultured meat, you know, gets you a lot further into a conversation with someone than talking about lab meat. Right.
Right. Yeah. So there's an active discussion going on sort of in this research community about, should we use clean meat? Should we use cultured meat? Does it matter which audience we're talking to? But pretty much everyone is on board with getting away from lab grown or in vitro or artificial meat.
Right.
It's the same sort of argument as calling cows beef or chickens poultry.
Exactly.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Time to use some similar
tactics.
We think
of clean as a more accurate terminology because it really does describe the process. It can be free from antibiotics. It's obviously free of fecal contamination and foodborne disease. So we feel that it's an accurate term.
You mentioned the animal concerns, and it's obvious that this new technology would be much better for the environment. But what about the health issues of cultured meat? Would it be, full of the same kinds of saturated fats and cholesterols and things like that?
Yeah, that's a great question. So this technology in particular does not address sort of the chronic human health concerns that would be addressed by moving to something like plant-based meat. Because you're absolutely right. It is the same product. It does have cholesterol and saturated fat. There is talk of developing in the future new versions of this where you can, for example, modify the lipid content so that you're selecting for lower saturated fat or something like that. But that's probably a few years out if that does happen. The health benefits that you do get are sort of more on the public health side. So, of course, a lot of the health repercussions that get externalized with animal agriculture have to do with environmental contamination and antibiotic resistance in bacterial strains and things like that that maybe don't come directly back to the consumer in a single meal. Sometimes they do in the case of, you know, food poisoning, E. coli and such. But sort of these larger societal health implications of animal agriculture, those absolutely will be addressed by clean meat production.
Right. And I'm glad you talked about antibiotics because that's certainly a hot topic right now with, you know, this great concerns nationally about antibiotic resistance. And here we are using 80% of the antibiotics on farmed animals. And so this product is something that, you know, would be free of antibiotics and growth hormones and salmonella, is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. It's kind of an ironic situation that, you know, our government's funding all of these research labs to urgently try to find the next generation of antibiotics, while we're also subsidizing animal agriculture, which is a large part of the reason we're in this situation. So, yeah, it would be great to get away from that.
Let's switch gears a little bit and talk more about the other aspect of your company's research in developing other plant-based products. Do you want to tell us about a few of your new products you're working on?
Absolutely, yeah. So we work with everything from early-stage academic researchers through startups, through more established companies. So rather than talk about specific products happening all along those lines, I think it's more exciting for me to talk about sort of broader up-and-coming technologies that we see in this area.
Okay.
Because that's a lot of my role at the Good Food Institute is helping to kind of map out what research has already been done, what still needs to be done in our eyes, what areas are sort of ripe for spinning off into the commercial sector and what areas are more early stage and need more academic research. So there's a couple angles of this. One is developing new plant-based proteins to be used. So if you look at, especially within plant-based meats that are on the marketplace right now, most of them are soy-based. A lot of them have wheat or gluten or some other protein from the wheat family. Very recently, pea protein has come on the scene, but that was not really a player 10 years ago, so that's propped up fairly quickly. But essentially everything we have on the market is based on sort of those three crops as the main ingredients. So there's this whole world of essentially completely unexplored plant proteins for use in plant-based meat. So some companies, especially over in Europe, are getting a little more innovative using things like lupin. We're starting to see fava beans and chickpeas come up on the scene. But again, there's, you know, something like soy or wheat has decades of research into its functional properties and how can we, you know, process it in a way to get sort of the structure we want from a plant-based meat and so on. And all of these other plant proteins, none of that research has been done to a large extent. So I think that's a very exciting area, is looking at functional properties of new plant protein sources. Another area that's really exciting is looking at the mechanical processing itself to give that texture that we want from meat. So almost all of the plant-based meats that are on the market right now are made through a process called extrusion, which is essentially, you know, using a couple of turning gears and very high temperature, high pressure environment to kind of squeeze out this product and give it a texture, a fibrous texture like we expect from meat. But that sort of limits what raw materials you can use, and it's a little bit of a black box still in terms of how the product comes out. There's a lot of variables in that process that aren't well characterized. So another exciting area is looking at new processing equipment and new processing strategies. So, for example, I just got back from the Netherlands where we were looking at one research group there that's developed a technology called a couet cell, which essentially applies shear force to plant proteins to kind of structure them in that aligned, you know, fibrous texture like meat. And that's, you know, much lower temperature and much lower pressure, so you can use more diverse raw materials inputs and gives a really different structure at the end of the day. So those are kind of two angles for expanding our palette of plant-based meats out there.
How far away are we from Star Trek style food synthesizers?
3D printing foods and all that?
Oh, yeah, 3D printing foods.
I've certainly seen some work on that. I think we're ways off from that. And why I say that is because everything, you know, not just in agriculture, but every sort of manufacturing benefits from economies of scale, right? So we're trying to reach price parity, especially with an industry that's as heavily subsidized as animal agriculture. I think that for the time being, we'll be looking at kind of conventional manufacturing as opposed to distributed. But I certainly like thinking about more futuristic things like that.
It's on the horizon. You know, Star Trek predicted flip phones and tricorders and all sorts of other advances.
Sure.
But how long do you think it'll be before cultured meat is widely available and at a cost that we can afford?
Yeah, that's a great question. And anyone who's sort of been following this field has probably seen anywhere from 5 years to never, depending whose article they're reading. So part of what I'm going to completely dodge your question and not give you an answer in the number of years, but part of what GFI is working on right now is we're performing what's called a technology readiness assessment of this whole industry. So this is an approach that actually was developed by the Department of Defense, I believe, back in the 70s, and it's used in a number of different industries, including the aerospace industry, which is where our other senior scientist is coming out of. She actually left Boeing to take this job at the Good Food Institute. So a technology readiness assessment is a very methodical way of looking at sort of all of the moving parts that need to come together at once for a new industry or a new product to develop. So when people are looking at timelines for something like cultured meat or clean meat, depending what aspect of that process you're looking at, whether it's development of media that doesn't have animal products or getting the cell lines right so that you don't have to go back to a donor animal, or getting the bioreactors that can go to scale with cell culture like this, depending which of those aspects you're looking at, you might give a very different timeline, but the most accurate timeline will be based on looking at the whole field and all of these channels that need to intersect at the same time for this to become a viable industry, essentially. So we're currently in the process of going through this really rigorous evaluation of where the field is at in all of these different, they're called critical technology elements, all of these pieces that need to come together. So based on that, I think we'll have a much clearer idea of where the field actually stands in terms of the timeline for this.
You know, going back to, you know, you mentioned how animal ag is really heavily subsidized. And I'm curious, have you all found any obstacles on the regulatory front, you know, that the government's trying to dissuade people from pursuing these kinds of new endeavors and how we create food?
Yeah, absolutely. So, of course, animal ag is a very entrenched industry and has a lot of political history there. So we do have a policy department, and our policy director is not lobbying at all. There are, of course, we have the recently formed Plant-Based Foods Association that is kind of taking on that role, but that's completely separate from GFI, so we're not lobbying, but more exploring what are the regulatory hurdles that exist for these products. One example is we just filed a lawsuit pertaining to standards of identity, and this is essentially a term that means whether you can call something like soy milk milk,
yeah,
or do you need a different term for it altogether. So we had filed a Freedom of Information Act request and didn't get all the information we needed, so there's a suit ongoing with that. And again, this is just to level the playing field for these products, because there certainly are hurdles in that regard. Another thing our policy department is working on is mapping out what the regulatory pathway would look like for some of these new products. So for something like clean meat, people developing new products or who might want to start a company around this, or investors who might want to invest in a clean meat company, are sometimes a little bit hesitant because it's not yet exactly clear what that regulatory structure will look like in terms of approving this as a new food product.
Right.
For instance, is it regulated by the USDA or by the FDA, and what kind of demonstrations will have to be produced to show that it's safe and that it's the same product and so on. So our policy director is sort of mapping that out so that that's not this big looming uncertainty about how these will be regulated and approved.
Right. We've been speaking with Dr. Liz Specht, the senior scientist with the Good Food Institute. And we look forward to seeing you in person here, Liz, in a couple of weeks when you're the guest speaker for the Vegetarian Society of El Paso's Thanksgiving dinner. Thanks for being with us on today's show, Liz.
Absolutely. It's a pleasure. Thanks so much.